Does Occupy Wall Street mean this changes everything?
That morning, there were people in suit jackets on their way to work. There were Black and Latino workers who were there. There were African-American women dressed up in heels. There were people with beards, and there were people there with children. It was the most incredibly diverse group, and it continues to be really diverse. But that moment for me was this turning point moment of not only are we a movement, but this is different.
That's author and activist Marina Citrin. We talk with her about her essay in the first book out about the Occupy movement. The book is called This Changes Everything. And we delve into the pulp nonfiction of crack investigative reporter Greg Palast. We talked to him about his latest shocker,
Vulture's Picnic in Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Marina Citrin is one of the original organizers of Occupy Wall Street. She was among those who started meeting in early August to create the New York General Assembly. Citrin came to the work with a lot of experience of similar movements, first from her study of the horizontalism movement in Argentina that arose 10 years ago during that country's economic crisis. She edited a book about it, Horizontalism, Voices of Popular Power in Argentina. I caught up with her at her office in the CUNY Graduate Center in New York on November 21st to interview her about her essay in a newly minted book, the first book about the Occupy Wall Street movement. That book is called This Changes Everything, and Marina Citrin's essay is entitled The Chills of Occupied Power, The First Month of Occupy Wall Street. She had no idea when she and a few others started the New York City General Assembly that it would explode into the worldwide Occupy movement.
No, I had no idea, and I don't want to speak for everyone involved in planning it, but I don't think any of us really imagined. We definitely didn't imagine we were going to be part of launching a movement, but most of us didn't bring sleeping bags or tents even on the day of September 17th. We planned for one day.
And why do you think it took off like this at this time?
I'm not sure. I think there's been kind of bubbling under the surface a dissatisfaction, but I don't think it's accurate to just say it's a kind of anger or rage. I think it's a dissatisfaction, but a desire to talk, a desire to find one another more than anything. And I think that's what we're seeing in how people are organizing as well. It's not shouting and screaming in the streets. It's creating assemblies and talking to each other.
That really strikes me, what you say, because the first time I went down there to Zuccotti Park, two things really struck me. One is that everybody was having these conversations.
Yeah. I mean, our intention in planning September 17th, even though the call was to occupy Wall Street, those of us organizing in Tompkins Square Park early on, we called ourselves the New York City General Assembly. And what we wanted to do was open space for discussion. What are people thinking? What are our alternatives? So the plan for the 17th was to have multiple assemblies and then one large assembly, which is what took off. It's what people were so excited by. And I think even though people did come intending to camp, I think the idea that this was going to be an open space of discussion with one another, finding one another, and that kind of looking at each other in the eyes and talking is what kept people in Zuccotti Park and kept more and more people coming to participate.
The second thing is diversity, but I don't want to get to that yet. I want to stay in this conversations for a minute, because another thing that you say in your essay, and This Changes Everything, The Chills of Popular Power, is while the experienced organizers never imagined something like this, the new people who came just took it for granted that this was taking off. So on these conversations, what I saw were conversations going on between old hands, people who've been around as long as I have, which has been a long time, and people who had never imagined that they would be at a demonstration ever in their lives.
I think that's one of the most exciting and beautiful parts of all of this, and sometimes some of the most challenging. But even on the day of the 17th, while it was a protest, and it's true to call it a demonstration, by later in the afternoon, it already started to feel a little bit different than just a demonstration. And there were people, for example, I can remember seeing one couple, and I spoke to them because they were from way upstate New York, and they came with a cooler that they had on wheels, and they'd brought a tent and sleeping bags. And they were not your typical either protesters or organizers. They came with the idea of doing something against Wall Street and wanting to be there. And I think it was people like that, when you talk about diversity, that really opened up the possibility of it becoming a movement.
You've been studying movements like this for a long time. You studied Argentina. You wrote the book Horizontalism, which is about what happened in Argentina. For our audience, kind of briefly describe what that was about.
In 2001, right after the economic crisis in Argentina, people began kind of in that moment of crisis also organizing and organizing assemblies in neighborhoods. People were taking over workplaces. And I'd kind of heard rumors or via different emails and things like that, that they were using this form called horizontalidad, which I hadn't heard of in Spanish, and I speak Spanish, and I hadn't heard of in English. And it's a kind of horizontal form of decision making. And so I decided to go to Argentina and check it out, because what I'd heard in the descriptions of what was happening sounded so exciting and sounded like something I would want to see in the world. So I kind of had trouble imagining that it was really true, that what you desire is actually happening. And I went to Argentina, and it was true. Unemployed people organizing in these horizontal ways, trying to meet their needs. People who were middle class or had been middle class and after the crisis were no longer, but were organizing in assemblies, standing on street corners, looking to one another to solve their problems together. Workers taking over their workplaces when the bosses left and running them without hierarchy, without managers, and making decisions together. So in all different social classes, people were coming together, and in all of these spaces in this horizontal way. So what I saw in Argentina and what we're seeing now, not just in the U.S., but in Greece and in Spain and around the world, the ways people are organizing in mass assemblies, looking at one another, creating kind of horizontal democracy is, I mean, it's in some ways I want to say it's intuitive, or there's something that's just happening in around the world, and this is how people are organizing. But I did see it first in 2001, 2002 in Argentina.
Now, the horizontalism experiment in Argentina is now 10 years old. Where is it now? And how can you contrast, or can you contrast, this nascent horizontalism, North American style, with a more mature movement, Latin American style?
I see so many similarities, and we have this wonderful opportunity now to learn so many of the lessons of what happened in Argentina. I was actually just in Greece with someone from the movements in Argentina, and we were sharing experiences on all different levels in that way. But the movements continue in Argentina. There are many, many fewer of the neighborhood assemblies, so people who had been in the middle class, and that urban organizing on the street corners is much less. But the way that people organize is the same. So as groups come together, they assume this horizontal form of organizing. Some people refer to it, when I was last there last year, people called themselves hijos of the 19th and 20th. And so children of the 19th and 20th. The 19th and 20th are the 2 days that the popular rebellion began. So it's this marking point that people refer to as this kind of rupture when things broke open and new ways of organizing happened. So they see this kind of direct lineage to that, and then organizing in horizontal ways. So right now, for example, in the Andean region, up and down Argentina, there are hundreds of assemblies that are being organized by people in the countryside, and it's against international mines that will exploit the environment, destroy people's livelihoods. So people are organizing, and they're coming together in assemblies using the language of horizontalidad. It's just, this is the way when people resist, they come together, not just resist, but create something in that space. So it continues in Argentina, and the way we're seeing it around the world, I think it will also continue. It just kind of makes sense as a way of organizing.
It makes sense, and yet so many in the media are just completely flummoxed. They cannot get this. Where are the leaders? How is this going to continue without leaders? So let me ask you, how is this going to continue without leaders?
You know, I think, well, the mainstream media is totally confused, because we're so accustomed to being told what to do, and there's a hierarchy, and someone tells someone who tells someone, and that's just the way of things in the world. So in horizontal organizing, we decide things together. I don't think it's totally accurate to say there are no leaders. I think And this is something we've been discussing, we, people who are in Occupy Wall Street and different movements, the distinction between not having power over each other and not having leaders. So there are people who have experience, and as the movement becomes more diverse, we have a lot of people who are participating who have experience, you know, who maybe were in the civil rights movement or who are in the labor movement, you know, in radical forms of the labor movement, and we have a lot to learn from them. And when they speak, they're heard in a different way. There's a different kind of quiet when someone speaks about race, who was an organizer in SNCC, for example. So that person has a kind of leadership quality, and I think it's really important to talk about that. But that doesn't mean they have power over the group. It just means when we listen differently. Or perhaps people act differently, and then we have to think seriously about how we can hold one another accountable as well. And so these are newer conversations that are coming up. But I definitely think there are forms of leadership, and that's okay as long as we're transparent about it and we're not using it in a way that has power. It's the part that the media doesn't understand is, how is it that we don't have power over each other? How is it that people aren't making decisions for other people? It's the hierarchy part that they don't understand how we can function without. And in fact, people do better without hierarchy. And I mean better in the sense of, when you're in a consensus-based, not absolute consensus, but trying to come to agreement and compromise with one another, the more we talk and the more we come to a kind of agreement, the more likely we are to actually carry out that agreement, because we've all been a part of it and we all feel okay with it. When you vote or someone tells you what to do, a whole segment of the people involved in that discussion feel unhappy. So they're very unlikely to go and do whatever that decision is if they don't like it. If everyone feels pretty good about it and they were a part of making that decision together, they're more likely to actually do it. So even on the question of efficiency, that is often raised as, you know, one of the problems of these movements is they're not efficient, or direct democracy is not efficient. That's really just untrue. More people participate when they are a part of deciding what's going to happen in their lives.
When they take ownership and initiative.
Absolutely. When it becomes a part of, you're a part of the decision, and so you're more likely to then act on that decision rather than someone telling you what to do and you go home and you decide, well, do I want to do that or not? It's a different question than, well, I helped to make this proposal. Some of my ideas are embedded in the proposal. So, yes, I want to carry it out.
And yet there's also a lot of spontaneity. You know, people will break off. I've been at a number of the demonstrations. I was there November 17th. You know, people can do things spontaneously. How does one strike this balance between collective action and individual or small group action?
I think that is tricky. Part of it is through conversations together collectively. And we do have, from the beginning, principles of unity, and talk about things around those things that kind of hold us together. So not demands, but those principles that hold us together. So, for example, people do not act in violent ways towards other people. And that's something that's part of our principles, and people have stood by that in all of these different demonstrations or actions, or when people go off and do individual actions. There's a kind of respect for that solidarity with each other.
We're talking with Marina Citrin. She has contributed to the first book, this new book, This Changes Everything, the first book about Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement. And she is also the author of the book Horizontalism, which is a study of a very similar kind of movement that emerged out of the crisis, the economic crisis in Argentina in 2001. The other thing that really struck me, let's see, my first experience was October 5th. That's where the unions were. And I thought, okay, lots of diversity here because so many of the unions in New York, you know, are representing workers of color. And when I went to Occupy Wall Street, it seemed that over the period of time that I went there, it became more and more diverse. You know, African Americans and Asians and white folks in a way I have never seen before. You know, I've been around these movements for a long time. They've been very segregated for the most part. Even the civil rights movement had its white groups and it had its African American groups. How did this happen?
I don't know exactly how it happened. It's actually bringing tears to my eyes because I come from a multiracial family and parents who were involved in the civil rights movement. So it is so incredibly important. And looking at history, it's been some of our biggest challenges, whether it's around class or race, gender, sexual orientation. And there was the moment when we were going to be evicted from the plaza. That's not what they called it. It's when they were going to have the police were going to allow the cleaners to come in and they were going to evict the park temporarily. And by 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, the plaza was full to overflowing. There were people all over the sidewalks, on the streets, and it was more diverse, and it had increasingly become more diverse. But that morning, there were people in suit jackets on their way to work. There were Black and Latino workers who were there. There were African-American women dressed up in heels. There were people with beards, and there were people there with children. It was the most incredibly diverse group, and it continues to be really diverse. But that moment for me was this turning point moment of not only are we a movement, but this is different. This is something, I mean, that this changes everything. The title of the book really is significant because something completely different has happened. And I think perhaps part of it is related to this idea that it is an all-inclusive movement, with the exception of people who do harm to other people, whether that's economic or physical, that kind of harm. But it is an all-inclusive kind of movement. And I believe it's also linked to the forms of democracy we're using, that it is a participatory form where people come and can talk and can listen to each other. And that's something that we don't have in our society. And I don't think we can underestimate that, the fact that this isn't a democracy based on actual participation. And that's also true in unions, in a lot of organizations and groups that I've been involved in the past, radical groups or progressive groups that don't have that same form of participation. And people desperately want to hear one another and to speak to one another. And I think that's part of what opens it and allows it to be more diverse. And again, I am going to stress the facilitation part, that when we have assemblies, that they're not just wide open, that we are really conscientious about who's speaking, about thinking about power and making sure there's space for all people to speak. And I think that's really important in the different groups all over the country, that we need to pay a lot of attention. The idea that we have a stack and that word is used is like a deck of cards. You know, I kind of visualize it in that way, and that you shuffle it so that people who want to speak, it's not just a list. It's someone keeps those names of people who want to speak, but paying attention to the diversity of those names. So you shuffle the stack so that if four men have spoken and three more men raise their hands and then a woman raises her hand, the woman goes to the top of the stack, for example. So people whose voices are heard less are moved forward. And part of that idea is also that the more one sees someone like yourself speaking, you're more likely to speak. So as a woman, when I see more women playing a leading role, I'm more likely to step forward than if I don't. And that's the idea with stacks. So these things that can seem small, or that the media definitely doesn't understand, or thinks we're kind of fetishizing some kind of process, they're all very consciously intended tools to open as much democratic space as possible.
There's also been outreach. Very early on, there was a march, was it right? A march up to Harlem? You know, there's been a conscious effort to reach out. Talk a little bit about the outreach, which of course is so important because now people can know there's no longer a place where people can just stay and have those conversations. How are those conversations going to continue?
Outreach has been really important, even from before September 17th. We had an outreach group reaching out to unions and different organizations and groups. Individuals still came to participate. So union members would come to the plaza, and then the union officials said, we endorsed, and you know, people voted, the membership voted to endorse the occupation. But there were members who were coming all along. And the space we do still use. So people are going to Zuccotti Park, and we are still having general assemblies in that plaza. I'm in more and more spaces around New York. I think the idea was to spark our imaginations as to what's possible and the idea of coming together and how we come together. So whether that takes place right around Wall Street or in different neighborhoods, the important part is that we come together, and that we come together in very public ways, I think, is also really important. So for Harlem, for example, people actually started meeting in the very first week of the occupation at Zuccotti Park. Some young people had been involved in Occupy Wall Street but lived in Harlem, and so started to organize Occupy Harlem, even though they're not actually occupying. It's the name and kind of the idea of occupying space and opening up space together. And now in Harlem, it's not just, you know, their assemblies and they're talking about very concrete things. they're also helping. There's a building where the heat was going to be turned off. And so people who are involved in Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Harlem are occupying that building. So the heat's not been turned off. And it's now been, I think, at least 2 weeks that they've been able to keep the heat on. So also doing very concrete things in neighborhoods. And hopefully this is the direction we're going to go in more and more. There's an Occupy Brooklyn, there's a Staten Island, there's Queens, there's Bronx, there's actually an East and West Harlem. So the idea is to organize more and more in our neighborhoods, but then to come together in the assemblies, both in our neighborhoods, but in the city as a whole. So to continue to use parks and plazas and churches and spaces as much as possible to have the assemblies, but to start doing more concrete work in our neighborhoods as well.
I've also heard that there's an Occupy Congress. And so this raises the whole issue. Of course, the Tea Party movement, you know, may have been a grassroots movement, but then quickly became AstroTurf by accepting a lot of money from folks like the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity, etc., their front groups. And then they took over the Congress quite quickly. This is a very different kind of movement. It's not about electoral politics, but is there a place for electoral politics in it?
That's not my desire or position, actually. My focus, and I think most people who've been involved in the plazas and organizing on the streets, want to continue to meet our concrete needs and use forms of direct democracy and open spaces to talk to one another and kind of create that alternative with one another. That will inspire other people who might not have the same kind of political perspective, so want to transform things electorally, change laws. And that's not bad. That legislation has changed. That maybe raises unemployment insurance or prevents people from being evicted from their homes, and people want to lobby for that. That's fine. That's great. I don't think that's the movement itself, but I think it's a product of the movement. So I actually think that the movement itself and those people who've been organizing, we should continue to do what we're doing. I don't think we should get involved in electoral politics, because people will get involved in electoral politics, and they are, and they're not people who are coming out directly of the Occupy movements. So I think we should continue to do what we're doing because it's inspiring people to get involved in other ways that make more sense to them. So we can kind of run parallel with each other and see each other as part of the same general walk in the same general direction. But that doesn't mean we need to leave the plazas and stop our assemblies because other people want to do an Occupy Congress. They can do that. That's great. We'll be friends.
And maybe there may even be people within the Occupy movement who want to do that as a branch. Would that be contradictory?
It might be contradictory, actually. Yeah, I do have some fear. Because historically, so many movements, and I could speak about Argentina, for example, because I lived there after the crisis, and a lot of what happened in Argentina, some of the challenges to the movements were people coming from more the perspective of either electoral politics or far left political parties, both wanting to take over all of this energy from the movement. And it did split it a bit. The left political parties was more just people trying to take over the agenda and going on and on and on for so many hours demanding things that people wanted. You know, we should end imperialism. Great. But do you really need to have a debate for 5 hours about it in a neighborhood that actually needs to have their electricity turned back on, for example? So that was a frustration. And a lot of people left the movement because of the left political parties. And then also the electoral folks, people coming in, trying to take the energy of the movement to push towards getting someone elected. And then as soon as that person is elected, all of the energy of those people who had been in the movement is related to that person who was elected, so related to power from above rather than power with one another. And that's another big danger and has derailed a lot of movements. So our learning from that and continuing to do what is working, what we've been doing so far is incredibly effective, and that is being with one another in our assemblies in directly democratic ways, organizing actions, continuing to put incredible pressure on this system of exploitation and oppression that exists. Absolutely, we have to keep that pressure on and continue to work with one another in relating to each other in these assemblies that are creating the alternative as much as possible in our relationships and meeting more and more our concrete needs and needs with one another, but looking to each other, not looking to those people in positions of power who got us into this problem in the first place. I think that would be a huge mistake.
We're talking with Marina Citrin. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. She's written the book Horizontalism and also has contributed to the very first book, at least that we're aware of, about the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's called This Changes Everything, and it's out from Yes Magazine. Occupy Wall Street obviously is talking about what's wrong with this system, this predatory capitalism that has, you know, is bringing this society, this economy, this planet to the brink and possibly over the brink of disaster. What are alternative economic ideas, forms, practices, organizing is going on, or even just at this maybe moment thinking about alternative economics is going on within Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement?
We're just beginning to have conversations about this. I think so many of us were so surprised that a day turned into a week, turned into a group, turned into a movement. And so we're seeing ourselves, and I think taking ourselves much more seriously. And so that does mean thinking about restructuring how society is organized. Absolutely. So that partially means thinking about our neighborhoods and very concretely about how we're organizing in our neighborhoods, but it also means talking about our workplaces and our schools. So the students this week have really begun to organize, not, you know, it's in some places, the new school, for example, to occupy, but to organize in CUNY, having assemblies over the past few weeks. There have been assemblies at Columbia and all of, you know, the different schools throughout New York, most of the CUNYs. And from there, also, I think the workplaces are another part of the conversation. And that might be first just having democratic assemblies in a workplace. It could be retaking the union or doing something parallel. In Argentina, sometimes the unions were an obstacle to workers recuperating their workplaces. So they did it without the unions. But forming the assemblies together and thinking seriously about alternative forms of production and alternative forms of value. I think that's something that in Argentina and the workplaces, people are producing, and they're actually, you know, as the recuperated workplaces go on for a few years, they're doing better than they were salary-wise before. But the choices they make are not based on what will make them the most money or will they be the most competitive workplace. They base it on spending time with their families and loved ones and supporting each other in the different workplaces. And these are not people who were political in any way beforehand. They, out of necessity, they took over their workplaces, came together, and they continue to help one another out of this, we need to help one another, and this form of direct democracy works best as a way of doing it. And what people will say is they feel happier. And that's not something that we're used to talking about. It's a whole other area that I would love to talk about. But I think that happiness, that when we come together in our assemblies and we go home and we're feeling better, we feel more community. And in the workplaces, they feel better with themselves, with their community. And that is a kind of value that's not a capitalist value. It's kind of values value, but it is what's motivating how they're running the factories, the way they're running the factories. And if we use that as our inspiration and think about the kind of society we want and rethink what motivates what we do, we need to survive, of course. How do we do that together and what's most important to us? So thinking differently about value production in the sense of a different kind of politics that's based in affect is something they say in Argentina, política afectiva, so affective politics with an A, basing it on kind of trust and love and what you desire. I don't just think, I know that resonates. That is why hundreds of thousands of people around the country are organizing, are coming together. Is just, it's on the one hand, okay, we've had enough, but simultaneously looking to one another and saying, okay, so what do we do, neighbor, friend, whoever? People are finding each other and trying to figure out alternatives, and it is based in this need and desire and happiness quota.
That was Marina Citrin. And the book in which her essay, The Chills of Occupied Power, appears is This Changes Everything. It's out from Yes Magazine and Barrett Kohler Press. Next up, Greg Palast lets us in on his newest investigation into petroleum pigs, power pirates, and high finance carnivores. Stay tuned after the break.
By the game they're playing. Come on, meet me down. It's a car. call you again. The plans to stand together up to green.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Greg Palast is a Sam Spade of investigative reporting. Like his hero, Raymond Chandler's character Philip Marlowe, Palast is the consummate gumshoe, staking out his targets while freezing his bleeps off in back alleys in Baku or devising clever ruses to ensnare them in their palatial homes. His targets? BP executives, corrupt rulers of oil-soaked dictatorships, and the financial vultures that scavenge the debts of poor countries, making them even poorer. His new book, Vulture's Picnic, uncovers the connection between predatory finance and dirty energy. Along the way, he reveals the nuclear and oil industry's flagrant disregard for safety. Case in point, BP's Deepwater Horizon disaster, Palast says, wasn't an accident. It was a crime scene. It's gripping and scary reading. Greg Palast does his investigative reporting for BBC Television, The Guardian, and Democracy Now! I sat down with him at an undisclosed location, the place where he and his assistant, the talented and multilingual Miss Badpenny, plan their sleuthing. Well, Greg Palast, thanks so much for welcoming Writer's Voice into your lair here.
It's thrilling to have you here, as a matter of fact, right inside where it's done.
So this book, Vulture's Picnic, this whole story starts when there was a confidential memo that was delivered to your assistant's desk, Miss Badpenny. And this happened during the Deepwater Horizon blowout as that was going on. Tell us what that memo was about.
Yeah, well, that's because this is a real pulp nonfiction, the real thing. Deepwater Horizon explodes. Badpenny, my chief investigator, and I were in Vegas, actually looking, digging into Chevron, and we get a cable from a ship floating in the middle of the Caspian Sea saying, "I have the information. I know what's going on, but I can't talk through this IT system." So I set up a secure line to someone floating in the Caspian Sea, which is in the middle of Asia, off the coast of Azerbaijan. If you don't know where the coast of Azerbaijan is, don't worry. When the 82nd Airborne arrives there, you'll figure it out. One of those Islamic republics pooped out by the Soviet Union at the time. So what we are finding is that the answer to the Deepwater Horizon investigation, which I was assigned to cover for British television, prime time, where I work, and we have to work our way into Baku, the capital. It's not easy to get in. We had to use subterfuge, of course, and it's really difficult to get out, especially in my case when I got arrested, when they figured out that I was hunting down what really was going on with BP.
Now, BP and Baku and Deepwater, what's the line here?
Okay, in Vulture's Picnic, it's a series of investigations from Fukushima, financial vultures, Congo, but the core thing I'm looking at is the British Petroleum operations worldwide, in particular, what really happened on the Deepwater Horizon. And one of the things we find out early on in the chapter called Lady Babaland, the Islamic Republic of BP, we find that there was a prior Deepwater explosion, which BP had covered up. It was BP rig, Transocean rig, same crappy cement that they used in the Gulf, and it blew out there 2 years before the Deepwater Horizon, and they covered it up. Now, I used to be a racketeering investigator before I was an investigative reporter. I can tell you, in the old days, cover-up meant fraud and racketeering. And it changes the Deepwater Horizon disaster from an accident to a homicide because they have covered up the fact they knew that they were using an inherently dangerous method. But how they covered up is very important. We get arrested, cutting across the desert. I'm trying to get to the BP terminal. And they grab my film, which is, of course, the first thing they do when I say they. First BP police, and then the security agencies, and the military police, and they grab us, and we're under arrest. So the first thing, give us your film, right? But yeah, they took the film, but then what they didn't take my pen, well, you know, as a journalist, and what they didn't know and didn't check was that Badpenny had given me one of those Austin Power jobs that has a camera, a video camera in it. So I got the evidence and came out with the evidence. That wasn't easy either because they found the pen, by the way, later. It still got out. with the evidence that there was a prior explosion. BP had covered it up. And by the way, just so you know, under British law, I had to present all my evidence to BP in London of not only that they had the prior explosion, which they covered up, which they lied to the SEC, they lied to Congress about, but how they covered it up. They covered it up through bribery, massive millions of dollars of bribes, beatings, babes, all the B's in BP. You know, they actually, Lord Brown, the CEO of BP, flew his private 727 into Baku and had the local officials picked up and flown back to London for lap dancing for the weekend. These cover-ups, this activity, the bribery, which is also against U.S. law, they didn't deny it. And rather, you can see at vulturespicnic.org, where I'm going to have a lot of these documents, you'll see that BP simply said, we followed all the laws. Now, wait, I said, did you commit bribery? Are there beatings? Did you lie? Did you commit perjury? Did you violate the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of the United States? I mean, these are serious charges. No direct denials of any of it. Mm-hmm. The only thing that they said is, we followed the laws.
So you're basically saying that they already knew prior that the cement would fail. You used to investigate or know about the cleanup technology. Tell us a little bit about this. The booms, for example, that we saw those pictures about. And there's also a lot of other stuff in this book, Red Palace Vultures Picnic, about how basically you call it a cleanup theater. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So what, you know, I was the head of the racketeering and fraud investigation of the Exxon Valdez when that blew out 20 years earlier. And I recommended racketeering charges against the oil company, not against Exxon, though I did name them as a co-conspirator. I said the main party responsible for 1,000 miles of destruction of Alaska coastline was British Petroleum, because they, BP, was in charge of preventing spills and cleaning them up. It's not rocket science, because you take a bunch of rubber, you use the technical word boom, but it's just a big, like, rubber. It's you know, put a big rubber around it, get these sucker ships, you suck it out, so rubber suck, and that's it. And it's no big deal, but you have to have the equipment. You have to have the rubber, you have to have the ships, you have to have the equipment, and you have to have people trained. And BP lied about it in Alaska. I mean, lied. They filled out forms in my investigation, which I have. We have them. They filled out documents saying, we will have equipment here. In fact, they said that they were going to have equipment on Bly Island, which is exactly where the Exxon Valdez hit. They were supposed to have all this emergency equipment. It wasn't there, because they figured, who's going to check it? A bunch of natives out there, you know, in their kayaks? A bunch of whales? Who cares? And so when the ship hit, the equipment that they said was there wasn't. Same thing in the Gulf. BP and Chevron and Exxon, the whole crew of them, had supposedly hired and set up this big spill response operation, and it was nowhere. I'm looking at that thing go up, and the oil's spreading all over. And by the time Obama declares a national emergency, the oil slick is bigger than the island of Jamaica. And there was no reason for that. None. The Gulf is not a terrible accident zone. It is a crime scene. These are crimes. And this is an investigation. Vulture's Picnic, what I call In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs and Power Pirates and High Finance Carnivores. I'm chasing these guys down, and I'm getting this evidence. You have to know these are crime scenes.
Vultures. Who are the vultures? And what's the connection between the vultures and this whole oil scenario? What's the connection between them and the petroleum pigs?
Vultures are financial speculators. I mean, I can think they're all vultures, but it specifically refers to these billionaires. In fact, the number one donor to the Republican Party is Paul the Vulture Singer. They proudly call themselves vultures. They are people who, speculators, billionaires mostly, who grab a hold of the debts of third world nations, buy them for pennies on the, when they say buy, bribery, blackmail, flim-flam fraud. They get their hands on old pieces of debt owed by nations which have gone through civil wars or whatever that everyone forgot. And they become like international repo men, scavenging for resources of these nations. I just came back from the Congo last week, where a vulture from Vulture's Picnic, a guy named Goldfinger, had somehow got himself from the Prime Minister of Bosnia out the back door some debt owed by Congo to Bosnia, weird thing from like 3 decades ago, or to Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist anymore. He's using that. He seized a hold of all the cobalt that was just shipped from Congo, which was to be used to end the cholera epidemic. So, I mean, these guys are really creepy. Goldfinger and then Paul the Vulture Singer. By the way, I just flew to Bosnia, following up from the book, we find out that the police have found out about Goldfinger and the prime minister, and they've recommended, they've now filed charges against the prime minister to have him, they said he should be arrested, and we're going to put him in jail. Okay, Paul the Vulture Singer, you'll see in the book, is he's grabbed the Republic of Congo. He paid a few bucks. Somehow he got his hands on some debt, and he's already hit the Republic of Congo for nearly $500 million. That's everything they have. What's happening is they have oil, for example, in Congo. When they try to ship it, these guys grab, they're like legalized pirates. And when I say legalized, it's not quite clear. They're outlaws in England. They're outlaws in most of Europe. They're just not outlaws in the USA.
So you're saying they buy the debt of a country for pennies on the dollar from the other country. And then they come in, and if they can't get the cash, they get the oil.
They get the oil. But I want to make clear, in the case of Bosnia, it was a crime. This is a stolen security, and the prime minister is going to end up in prison. In the case of Zambia, it was a $3 million bribe. Bad penny follows the president of Zambia with his $3 million. He's dropping off in a Swiss bank account. She speaks several languages, so she went in speaking French or German. And, you know, doing a reality show, shopping the rich and famous, and asked, will anyone important come in here shopping? Yeah, the president of Zambia, he just dropped $1 million buying 200 pairs of elevator shoes and a diamond studded tie. So we get this stuff. So it's bribery, blackmail, theft, fraud. In the case of Liberia, I'm chasing throughout the book a mysterious group called the Hamsa. Hamsa, if you know, is Arabic for five, and it also means an evil eye and an open hand. And I'm trying to figure out who Hamsa is. And I go to Africa, and I actually warn the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who just got the Nobel Prize, that there's someone corrupt, a finger of the hand in her cabinet. Mm-hmm. By the way, she fires her entire cabinet after that. She knows that it's corrupt. Someone's corrupt. Maybe they're all corrupt, but at least one's corrupt. So she fired the entire cabinet to just make sure she got the one. Yeah, these vultures were choking this nation to death. But you have to understand, these are the top funders of the Republican Party. And it's not by the way, they also not exactly ungenerous to the Democrats. It's not these vultures are definitely bipartisan carnivores.
Let's go back to the oil and see if we can weave in some of the vultures here as well. You went to Alaska after you went to Baku. You got a note from the intelligence chief of the Free Republic of the Arctic. This man, he's impressive. Tell us about him, and why did he want you to come there?
Well, the intelligence chief is his intelligence chief, but the chief himself is Etok, who is the leader, the militant leader of the Eskimos of the North Slope of Alaska. And I get this note from the chief of intelligence of the Free Republic of the Arctic. I mean, this is this is a joke. Where is this from? And it says, come up to Kaktovik right away. Kaktovik. I look on Google Maps. It's a little island above the Arctic Circle in the Beaufort Sea. When it turns out that it's from Etok, who is the famous whale hunter chief of the Eskimo, I do go up. And he brings me, and we go inside a whale carcass, which is as big as a house, and eat some whale meat, fermented whale meat and congealed blood. And he's making a point. He says, they're trying to drill here, and he wants me to get across to BP and the Queen, where she can stick her oil well. And I said, that's anatomically impossible. But what's tragic is that Obama, just a few months ago, as the book ends, he authorizes drilling right off Kaktovik, which, as far as the natives are concerned, I mean, whales don't swim in oil any more than you or I do, and that's pretty much the end of the Eskimo.
The view that we're getting, that I got in reading this book, Vulture's Picnic, Greg Palast, is that, you know, drilling in the Arctic is really talking, because of the corruption, because of the lies, because of the total lack of safety in any way, shape, or form, we have a lot to fear from drilling in the Arctic as well as drilling from anywhere. And this is really what you're showing in the book.
Well, they couldn't drill in the Gulf, which is pretty easy stuff. Yeah. Okay, these guys, they can drill safely, but that costs money. It's all about the money. They're not in the business of finding oil. They're in the business of finding your money.
So you talk about pigs. I mean, you have petroleum pigs here, but that's a double entendre.
Yes.
Because there's a really chilling. I mean, here we've just gone through this XL pipeline struggle, which is not over, we should say. I mean, they're going to reroute it. We're talking thousands of miles of pipelines, pigs. Tell us what pigs are and why this is also so much of a dangerous part of this lack of safety issue.
Well, when I talk about petroleum pigs in Vulture's Picnic, it's not just the porky bonus bloated executives that get sucked into a pipeline. There is a robot pig. It's called a pipeline inspection gauge. It's a robot. It's the only thing that ensures that these pipelines are safe and don't blow up and kill us. Don't, like the XL pipeline, don't spill all over and poison our aquifers for thousands of miles. It's the only thing we've got. In other words, they put this robot right into the pipe, and it goes with the oil or gas, and it beeps and boops when there's anything wrong. Corrosion, rust, it's too much pressure, a leak, a break, it's about to explode, it's about to leak or bust. It tells us. That's what they do. They just run through. It's very simple, except if the pig gets silenced so it doesn't squeal. And what one of the investigations I'm on, I find a guy we can only call Pigman. And I speak to the others on his team as well, Pigman 1 and Pigman 2. There's a Pigman 3. And they are telling us that they are on the team which designed the software. And they tell us the software is fixed so that the pig doesn't squeal. And it's a violation of the law. The law is very clear about you've got to shut down a pipe and replace the corroded, busted, leaking segments that the pig identifies. So what they do is it's just a lot cheaper to dial down the pig. It's like taking, you know what it is? It's like taking the battery out of your smoke detector. That's fine unless you have an actual fire. Same with the pig. And this is to save these guys billions and billions in pipeline replacement costs. The problem is the pig man came to me finally agreed to talk to me when 9 people were incinerated in California when a pipe burst and he knew the pig had run through that and didn't identify anything. That pipe was totally cracked, leaking, was ready to blow. And he said, it's no longer about software. It's about killing people.
And talking about killing people, Fukushima. This comes in too. Nuclear energy is something a lot of people say, well, we're going to go from oil to nuclear. I tell you, I'm shaking in my boots after reading this book, Vulture's Picnic, because it's just fundamental safety problems. Tell us what happened to Fukushima and why should we be scared right here?
See, it's not about inherent lack of safety in a nuclear plant. I'm not anti-nuclear. I am anti-fraud and anti-crime. I was a fraud investigator. I directed the U.S. government's investigation of the big nuclear builder, Stone & Webster, many years ago. When I saw Fukushima melting down, I knew exactly what happened because the earthquake proofing failed. Oh, they said it was an earthquake we didn't expect. Well, it was a 9.0 earthquake. Yeah, it was a big earthquake in the middle of the ocean. By the time that shake got to Fukushima, it was a tenth of that power, a tenth, maybe 1% of that power that it was in the ocean. That plant should have stood. Why didn't it? Well, the answer is I go back into my files, and you can actually see in Vulture's Picnic the actual handwritten documents by the engineers. Every engineer keeps a little notebook that they fill in every day in a nuclear plant. They have to by rule and law. And we got the old notebooks, and I went back to 1988 files, and it says, no way can this plant withstand an earthquake. That's a quote from the handwritten notes, and that the parts would, quote, utterly and completely fail in an earthquake. They knew, the company Stone & Webster, that design. Now, I took that to a jury. A jury found them guilty of fraud and racketeering, hit them for their co-conspirators for $4 billion. And Stone & Webster is saying, well, it's a happy ending. We can have good nuclear plants because they're out of business. Well, wait a minute. Stone & Webster changes shape and becomes a unit, the nuclear unit of Shaw Construction. The Obama administration has just approved 4 new nuclear plants. All 4, everyone, will be built by Shaw Construction. This is the company that faked the earthquake proofing. And by the way, they got the contract to rebuild Fukushima. So don't sleep tight, because the problem is that it's so expensive to build a safe nuclear plant. Maybe you can build one, maybe you can't. But I can tell you this, if you do, it's untold billions to make it really safe, to make sure it can stand an earthquake. And an earthquake, by the way, it's a seismic event. That could also be, you know, a Valentine from Al-Qaeda that shakes the building. And the problem is that steel and cement and fraud are equal elements in building a nuclear plant.
Well, there's also the issue of the diesel generators, which, if anything, scared me even more. I mean, I live near the Vermont nuclear plant, which is right on the Connecticut River. We've got Millstone that's here. They're right by the water. You're saying these diesel generators can't get wet?
They can't get wet. and they don't work. These emergency diesel generators, as I find out from Diesel Man, another source, the problem is they don't work in emergencies. These are old. All these things, they look big, they sound noisy when they snap on, but they're old cruise ship engines that have been offloaded from cruise ships and stuck in these nuclear plants, and they are not meant to snap on in 12 seconds. When you cruise out to the Bahamas, they take a half hour to warm these things up in the bearings. So what happens? How come the diesel generators at Fukushima failed? And failed, by the way, at the Surrey nuclear plant just recently. The answer is they're not meant to snap on like that, to go up to full power in 12 seconds, which is what they're supposed to do. So it's a fake, but it's a cheap fake. They get these old diesels, and they fire them up, and they never test them. And so when we did a racketeering investigation, we required them to be tested. Three engines at the Shoreham nuclear plant in New York. One failed in an hour, one failed in 2 hours, and one failed in 3 hours. It's a fake. It's to make you feel that you're covered if something goes wrong. At Fukushima, those diesels, could not handle any water at all. And they were not protected against water, which is crazy. Because you protect your outdoor fixtures from water, right? And they don't do it with a nuclear plant. But even more important, most of those diesels actually didn't get wet. They committed suicide because when they were turned on, their crankshafts just went snap.
So in an emergency, these emergency diesel generators can't work.
Can't work. In other words, some may work, but the chances are, in every emergency we've had, most don't work. So you're in trouble because it is just there to pretend you're safe in case.
In this book, Vulture's Picnic, Greg Palast, we've covered maybe the tippy top of the tip of the iceberg. I want to ask you, you call this pulp nonfiction. You have a kind of persona. I mean, you're a crack investigator. You've been an investigator all your life, now an investigative journalist, have been so for a long time now as well. Why do you feel the need to kind of take on this persona of the, not a private eye, but kind of like a public eye?
Yeah, like Columbo is my. I think that I learned more about investigative reporting from Columbo than you could ever learn from the Columbia School of Journalism, which is not to take the official line. Don't buy it. This is who I am. In other words, I've had a certain way of approaching things forever. In fact, I'm known for wearing a fedora like Columbo, but I've actually worn a fedora for 40 years. And I didn't think about it till I went on television in Britain because I did an undercover investigation of the prime minister. And then the prime minister attacked me and said, never trust a man in a hat. At that point, BBC television said, you have to wear your hat all the time now because the prime minister attacked you for wearing it. But I wear it anyway because I don't have hair and I need it to keep the rain and sun off. But if you really do the work, if you do really, really serious work in investigating, and if you read Raymond Chandler's writing about investigators and real investigative reporters of the old style, when he wrote those stories of Philip Marlowe, they were based very, very much on real characters. If you're going to do real investigating, if you read Raymond Chandler, he based his character, Philip Marlowe, as he explained, on real investigators and real old-fashioned style investigative reporters that don't exist anymore. They used to be at the LA Times stuff. If you do real investigating, this is how it really works. It's much more real than you think. Now, it's a lot more boring in reality than the book shows or Raymond Chandler novel because that's all compressed. And when I say boring, not for me. I love going through files and files and spending hours and hours and hours documents. So does Bad Penny. I mean, we just love numbers. We love going through old dusty files. You go through the back alleys of Baku. And you have to understand, when you're on a stakeout, like I try to explain in the book how it's really done. When I'm on Democracy Now! Or BBC and you see me jump out of a car at some bad guy and shove the evidence in his face or, grab the president of Zambia or something like that. You just see that moment. What you don't see is sitting in the car for hours and hours and hours and hoping that you don't have to pee and that the Dunkin' Donuts coffee is freezing on you and then they're going to catch you. And I was just with Ricardo, my Gonzo cameraman last night, who's just taking off now for undercover work in Yemen and dangerous stuff. But we were talking about how lucky we were on our last vulture hunt that we didn't spend like 5 days waiting, hiding to just grab a glimpse of this guy. We got lucky. So it's a lot of work. And, you know, understand these targets, Goldfinger, he doesn't list himself in the phone book. Paul the Vulture Singer isn't going to talk to us. He's worth $4 billion and he owns the Republican Party.
And so how do you find them? Can you talk about how you found even one of these guys?
We use a lot of subterfuge. Oh, one of my favorite ones is that when I, in the opening chapter to grab one of the vultures and one of these fraudsters, a billionaire, he has a big estate and there's a tennis court there. So we had this wacky idea. I actually enlisted John McEnroe, the tennis pro, who agreed we were going to go. Our idea was to go and in our tennis whites with a camera so we get approval to get on his big estate property and say, we're doing a reality show. So you think you know how to play tennis, starring John McEnroe. Now, do you want to knock around some balls with the champ? So you get the guy out there on the tennis court with his rackets and little tennis whites, and then instead of tennis balls, we pull out the evidence and say, would you answer these questions? Now he's already given us permission to be on his property and film. So whatever it takes, you know, we'll get some official detective agencies that will also help us get certain into databases legally. We don't break the law. That's our one rule. We don't break the law. But we do something that's just not done in the United States, which is real investigative reporting. We do go undercover. We will use false fronts. Again, we have to get that approved by the top levels at BBC. You know, I set up a big sting operation with the big American power companies. Of course, they set up a sting on me, as you find out in the book. they catch me with a young lady while I was trying to get some information and get lucky maybe at the same time, but I got set up. It happens. As you know, if you read Vulture's Picnic, that I lose the James Bond award about once a week by making some really dumb. It doesn't seem dumb until afterwards. Then you go, why did I do that? Why did I go up those stairs? Why did I take off my pants? Why? You know, you do ask yourself these questions afterwards. You say, that was not bright. So I want people to also understand when I fail. And part of that is to understand, I want people to understand my personal failings in here. First time I kind of talk about my personal life, because I want people to understand I'm quite normal. I'm just like any other person. I just happen to be put in extraordinary circumstances with an extraordinary task, but I'm quite an ordinary guy.
And a risk-taking one, and thank God for that. Greg Pallast, your book is Vulture's Picnic. It is a terrific read. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. What a thrill to tell the story.
Greg Pallast is also the author of the New York Times bestseller Armed Madhouse and other books. You can read an excerpt from Vulture's Picnic by going to writersvoice.net. And you'll also find links to Greg Pallast's website, where you can see videos and documents related to his latest investigations. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.